Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/curd.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comte-usa.com. That's comte-usa.com.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. My name is Aaron Foster. I'm your host for today. And joining me remotely via satellite interlink is Mateo Keeler from the Cellars at Jasper Hill. Mateo, if you've listened to the show at all and know anything at all about cheese, he probably needs no introduction, but that won't stop me from giving one anyway. Mateo is the co-founder of Jasper Hill Farm and the Cellars at Jasper Hill, along with his brother Andy, which they've grown into just a remarkable business up in the Northeast Kingdom in Vermont, making cheese, maturing cheese, growing hay, doing all sorts of just vertically integrated cheesy greatness. And we are going today to have him join us and discuss COVID-19, which I know you've all probably reached your limit on, but I think it's important that we keep talking about it and keep thinking about it. So welcome, Mateo.
I'm so glad to be here with you, Aaron. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. We've known each other a long time, and I miss you.
I know. I can't wait to maybe tip one back with you when this is all over. And
yes, break bread and some.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Let's dive right into it. I guess I'll kind of bring us around to the beginning, which is just that probably 3 or 4 episodes ago, I did a show with my co-host Elena Santigade about sort of the beginnings of the COVID-19 situation and how we were handling it at my store, Foster Sundry. And, you know, I feel like this is one of those things where things are evolving on the ground on a weekly, daily, or even hourly basis. And we're constantly, I think I used the metaphor then of like building a plane while flying through the fog and knowing there are mountains around and trying to figure out how to get to your destination safely.
I describe it as riding a ping pong ball.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
And so, let's start. How are you holding up? It's like an emotionally draining kind of thing. And so, how are you
doing?
Yeah,
well, I think things are starting to... I think we've like transitioned out of emergency, like fight or flight mode, into what is now kind of like normal, new normal.
Yes, and, the new normal is the phrase I keep hearing around.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and I think we made a very conscious decision to start talking about this as being kind of a new stable place. This is how things are going to be. Communicating with our team about like masks are here to stay. You know, this is like we're into something that's stable. It's not like we have to like completely reinvent how we do our work you know, anymore. That we went through a crazy period of transition and change and adapting to, you know, just crafting a response to like the crisis as it was hitting, from an operational to like sales and like outreach, communication, work from home, like all that stuff happened all at once. And we're kind of, you know, sliding into this more, you know, less frantic mode.
Right. So you're kind of all of those initial, like, everything goes in a blender and we figure out what works and we kind of rebuild it as we're driving it kind of situation.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
you're through that initial Michigas.
Yeah. Thank God. Because that was, that was just exhausting. And not that, you know, everybody's working a lot harder, than, they were in our business, before, you know, pre-COVID. Life is harder. We're working more. There's been a huge amount of inertia that we've had to break in order to like really pivot as an organization, but it's working, you know.
How are you defining working, I guess, is one of my questions.
I guess I'd say that, you know, 6 weeks ago, this was like COVID represented like an existential moment for our business. The first thing we did when social distancing orders and, you know, shelter in place orders came down and restaurants and bars closed, was we made the really difficult decision to disperse our herd of cows at Jasper Hill.
Yeah, no, this got a lot of attention, certainly from the cheese industry and a lot of press. I mean, relatively speaking. And tell me a little bit about what that means. Like, that, you know, I feel like that obviously must have been a very emotional decision for you guys. And, you know, I think from the outside, was it like something that you had been thinking about at all before COVID, or did it just make, okay.
No, you know, it's like, we've always operated from this idea that the herd is the foundation, you know, of the business. The herd is the foundation of wealth. The herd is like at the heart of the business.
And, well, these are the Ayrshires, you know, that you first got when you just got started, right?
Yep. And so these would be, you know, the great, great, great granddaughters, some of them.
Sure. Of, right. They're not the same cows.
of the girls that started with us. Actually, 17 years ago, we made our first batch of cheese 17 years ago this week. But it was such a, it was a moment in which it was just really unclear how long this was going to last. And it's clear this is going to go on for some time. And our ability to survive it was going to be predicated on our ability to manage cash at a moment where we could see this just like radical decline, precipitous decline in our sales, right? And
so did that, you know, when things shut down, I remember in New York, there was basically a specific day when everyone was like, oh shit, it's real.
I think it was March 16th.
Yeah, I feel like in my brain it was a Thursday. Like, it's just the whole world decided that...
It was March 16th when, like, things really, like, started getting real for us up here. We're, like, you know, a little time delay here.
Right. And now, what did that look like for you? Because our experience down here, you know, we're experiencing it in New York City, at least, as like a very acute danger, like feeling a physical danger. But I have to imagine that for you guys up there, you know, your first effects were not this fear of like getting sick as much as where is the business going? Was that accurate or not as much?
My wife Angie is immunocompromised, and you know, we have elderly people in our, you know, our parents are around, and we have people in the business that are at risk, and so, you know, we never got the experience that you guys have lived through. You know, social distancing is a way of life up here. It takes right. 20 years to get
Vermont
to know your neighbor.
Time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and Vermonters have taken this incredibly seriously. You know, the curve in Vermont has been, like, flattened. You know, everything is moved to, like, curbside. Even in our, like, small community, you know, everybody's wearing masks. We've done a really good job of preventing, you know, a health catastrophe, because there are only 287 hospital beds in the state of Vermont, right? And so
that blows my mind. There's 287 people that probably live within 50 yards of me.
Yeah. And so, you know, Vermont doesn't have the infrastructure to, like, deal with a pandemic, and the response across the state from Vermonters everywhere has been pretty remarkable and effective. It's not over, though, you know, and it's summertime, and the big scuttlebutt around here is, you know, it's basically all those Bostonians and New Yorkers are about to start showing up. And I believe that our COVID challenges in our community are before us, right? So this isn't going to be over for a long time. And, you know, I think that that kind of jives with our, like, outlook as to what our market is going to look like over the next couple of years. And, you know, it's where, you know, this, it's the long haul. So just bringing it back to, like, selling off our herd of Ayrshires, which, you know, they went to two neighbors from whom we purchased milk, and a third farm, Andersonville Farm, that we manage. So those cows are still in the system. But
so they're in the extended family, so to speak.
Yeah, we have agreements to get their daughters back.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's great.
So the cows that left us that week won't be coming back, but it's likely their daughters will. And that's kind of the timeline that we're looking at for...
I mean, there's something really sort of poetic and I mean, hopeful about that, at the very least.
I'm clinging to that. I really am. You know, it's part of what has defined us, you know, being a farmstead cheesemaker from the beginning. And... you know, we don't sell milk, we sell cheese. And so the minute that there's too much milk in the system, we need to, like, manage our supply. And that really means limiting the number of animals that we're supporting and that are supporting us, right? It's
right, particularly if the amount of cheese you can sell down the road is steady or declining for the time being.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's been a real roller coaster on the sales side too.
I have to imagine. I mean, so you say that it really hit you kind of that March 16th date. You know, what were the things? What were the effects that you were feeling up there? Did Vermont lock down? Did you, like, have sales? Did people just call you and say, actually, we've changed our mind, or what happened?
Yeah, we had pallets of cheese on trucks that were refused. They're like purchase orders, you know, that were refused by customers. You know,
and normally, that, you know, if a customer wanted to cancel an order, they'd get in touch with you before you palletized and shipped all that cheese out of the caves.
Yeah, generally, when you have a purchase order, that's like a legally binding, like, commitment.
Right.
This was a scenario where, you know, some food service distributors lost 100% of their sales overnight, and we're just not going to be able to, like, take, you know, the cheese that they had ordered, even though it had already left our facility. And was on a truck bound for their loading dock. And
now, is that maybe a slightly better scenario than them taking the cheese and not having the market and you not getting the receivables?
Yeah, I mean, it's all pretty complicated, particularly when, you know, such a large proportion of our production is soft cheese, right? And so that was like one of the things that happened.
Meaning that it has like a relatively short shelf life, and tying it up in being refused and going all yeah. over the place diminishes
yeah,
that.
Expiring.
Yeah.
Expiring before you can find a home for it. And you know, and true to form, when shoppers went to stock up on cheese at retail in their panic buying and hoarding, they weren't hoarding soft cheese. You know, they're buying like commodity and cheddar and, you know, parm and cheese that was going to keep for a while. And so, you know, we found ourselves with all this cheese that we had made before COVID was an idea that was like registering in our world.
Right, you're working
for in the pipeline, yeah.
Yeah. So what are you, like, on a timeline for, say, Harbison, you know, how long that cheese gets made, how long before it hits market?
It's about 5 weeks when we ship it. So we had 5 weeks worth of Harbison in the pipeline before we could make a decision to, like, drop production, right?
Right. So it's like a fire hose just emptying out. And it's like, yeah. Well, the fire, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so when that happened, we ended up with about 12,000 pieces of Harbison that were, like, homeless, right? And we had about 10,000 Willoughbys.
I personally ate about 1,612, I would say, somewhere yeah. in there.
Yeah, it's, and, you know, we were able to really, like, communicate with our partners, you know, on the retail side of the business to move all of that cheese. And, you know, we ran some crazy deals. We had, like, buy one, get one free.
Yeah, I mean, just watched, yeah.
We gave away a lot of cheese. Yeah.
We took advantage of that, certainly, and you know, I sold a ton of Harbison, and it was great.
Yeah. And better for it to get out of the cellars and be enjoyed than you know, than the alternative,
right?
Which is like the compost pile.
Now, do you feel like this? So this was something we remarked on in the show that I did with Elena. This tendency for customers to be buying, to like retreat into their comfort zones and retreat into reliable, long shelf life cheeses. Do you feel like that initial reaction has softened at all?
Yeah, yeah, I do. I think you know, that we're seeing like our weekly orders like basically kind of stabilize. Still not like pre-COVID levels.
We like to call that BC, before COVID.
BC, yeah. Yeah, not, they're stabilized, but not like BC.
Right.
But they're, you know, they're trending in the right direction. And we've had some incredible support from some big players out in the marketplace. Murray's, Kroger and Whole Foods stepped up in a really significant way to help us like clear out you know, inventory that would otherwise have gotten past us. And
that's amazing, because normally for larger companies like that, you don't really think of them as being necessary. Like, you think of them as high volume, but not nimble or quick moving.
Yeah.
You know, certainly with Whole Foods. It, you know, speaking from experience, it can take a long time to push an item and a sale through their system.
Yeah. I think everybody recognized that there's one thing that we don't have in a crisis like that, and that's time. And I, you know, it's been remarkable, but it's not just like those bigger retailers. It's like independents, and everybody's pivoting and trying to you know, support both their own business, but the suppliers that you know, really form the basis of this ecosystem that we all inhabit together. And this is really, I feel like it's really like bringing, you know, bringing interdependence into focus,
right,
in a way that maybe it wasn't so clear, before, like BC.
Sure. Now, when you say interdependence, you just mean like how interconnected all of the, like all the different pieces of the supply chain are.
Yeah, you know, one thing that, you know, was really stressing me out was, like, looking out at a future in which, like, restaurants are gone, right? And so much of our business is the product, really, of the relationship between, like, chefs, their ingredients, and the people behind those ingredients, right? And so you're eliminating, like, a big swath of our market. And then you think about, I remember calling you up like the week after this all started going down, and it was not clear that your shop could survive this.
No, we were, I mean, there was a couple of days where we just, or I would say a couple of weeks where, honestly, I would go to bed at night being like, we have to close, like, you know, I'm not willing to take these risks. I'm not willing to put my staff at risk, and I don't know financially whether we can make it. And then I would wake up in the morning and change my mind entirely. And, you know, I still have those doubts and those questions about whether, you know, the risks are worth the staying open. But then I just, so many of our customers have come in and just talked about how the normalcy, the illusion of normalcy that's brought by being able to come into the shop and shop, is like a big part of their day. And that's honestly just that emotional kind of lift is what keeps us.
And for us on the like production side, you know, knowing that independent shops are out there and are thriving, or surviving, if not thriving, in this moment, that, you know, shops that have been able to pivot and be nimble and, like, you know, keep at least a bookmark in the marketplace, because, you know, shops support so many other businesses. And I was so stressed out by the idea of a post-COVID world, a PC world, mm-hmm. where there are no restaurants, there are no independent shops, and we're left with, what are we left with, you know, like
you're left with Olive Garden, and, right, and yeah. Big Box and Best Buys.
Yeah, and that was terrifying. And I think that the work that we've done over collectively as an industry, and that's happening now, is going to I think we're going to come out of this experience stronger as an industry in lots of ways, and so I'm optimistic that some good can come of this. And if there is one thing that I'd like to see is, you know, more like win-win-win type of partnerships that kind of really celebrate and support like the whole chain. Because
right,
we're
zero-sum arrangements. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I think what I'd like to, we're going to have to take a break in a second, but I think when we come back, maybe, you know, we've sort of talked ethereally or specifically about very businessy stuff, but I'd like to talk about kind of the human experience that you and your staff are having. So this is Cutting the Curd. We're going to take a short break to hear from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or a small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its Order Hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/curd.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
All right, welcome back to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I am Aaron Foster, your host for this COVID-19-focused look at supply chains and cheese businesses, both retail and production in our new world. My guest today is Matteo Keeler from the Cellars at Jasper Hill. So Matteo, we were discussing before we took a break. I think you had imagined a brave new world, or posited a brave new world and a better, happier one where PC, that is post-COVID, we might be able to rebuild our businesses and rebuild our business arrangements and supply chains in a way that makes them a little bit less zero sum and a little bit, I think you called it win-win-win.
Yeah, I like winning. Yeah, I like it when everybody wins.
We're going to win. You're going to be sick of winning. Well, there's going to be so much
winning. winning bigly.
So bigly. God. Tremendous.
Yes.
We'll set that aside for a moment. So tell me a little bit about, Vermont being a rural state, and an agricultural state. We have taken advantage just recently. We were able to get a PPP loan, through the CARES Act from the government. And, that's basically given us sort of a backstop to to allow us to rehire some people and pivot into online ordering and some things that we just didn't have the labor or the bandwidth to do. And it's I think the PPP is complicated for a variety of reasons. There are a lot of businesses that it isn't ideal for, but I think for businesses that have been able to remain open, but that have seen some struggles in terms of business dropping off, it seems like it could be helpful. Have you guys looked into, like, have you taken advantage of any federal or state stuff?
We're fully PPP'd. And,
you've PPP'd yourself.
Yeah, we PPP'd ourselves, and we did that like straight away. We banked with a community bank. We had an application, and 3 days later, it was approved. And the following week, we closed. So like basically, it was like 10 days from when we filled out an application to when we had like cash in our bank account.
And this was the first round?
This was the first round.
Wow! Yeah, you were the ones.
Yeah, we're
you and Ruth Chris.
We took all the money, and it was actually I would say fundamental to helping us make some good decisions about staffing early on when it was very dark. Our future looked very bleak.
When we spoke, you mentioned that conversation earlier. I think we both just felt real shitty.
Yeah, it was not hopeful. We couldn't see, a way through this. And PPP helped us. There's a combination. I think like taking, dispersing our herd and reducing our cash out demands, along with PPP, and we did all take a pay cut in the business. The combination of those things really kind of, but we didn't lay anybody off, right? We've been able to keep our whole team
intact. That's great. And, now, has anyone opted to furlough out of sort of fear?
No,
just concern. Okay, that's great. Yeah.
No. People in the business, I think, are really grateful to have a job. There's a lot of unemployment in Vermont, just like the rest of the country. People are very psyched to have a job, a good job, and I've taken. I basically started communicating broadly with everybody in our business in a very transparent and direct way about what's happening in the company and how we're trying to make decisions and where we are like week to week as this progresses. And, I think we're on the verge of like making everybody whole for the loss of pay so far, because we're climbing out of the hole we were in, and we're going to come out of this, and hopefully, PPP is going to like end for us.
Probably any day now, soon.
Yeah, it's soon. And we're actually hiring, because, wow. we are feeling pretty short staffed, because of what's happened, on the operations side of the business.
Now, what does that mean exactly?
Well, we had been making a lot of cheese and, washing and turning and brushing and packing a lot of cheese. We took our production, we dropped production, we dropped hours on the production side of the business. But at the sellers, our mail order business has just exploded. I think like year to date, mail order is up like 1,740% or something like that. It's ridiculous. We get, we've been getting like 1,000 orders a week, and there are weeks now where 50% of our sales are online.
Wow. That's crazy.
And
that's a higher labor business, obviously, but it's also a higher margin business.
It's we're working a lot harder than we were before, and but mail order is really keeping the lights on for us. And you know, for all you listeners out there, buying a piece of cheese from a retailer is the number one, option for us. Best option is go find yourself a retailer and like create demand for our cheeses in the retail.
I thought you were just about to tell people to just order from you instead of come to me.
No, we need our customers to survive this too. But there are lots of people that have not been able to access, you know, like good cheese, and that
retail.
Also
absolutely, of course.
Yeah, are committed to our success, and we're so grateful for that, because our ability to basically like pivot from, you know, washing a lot of Willoughby to like putting cheese in little boxes and sending them off into the world and giving people an incredible experience and connecting with them in a new way has been it's a lot of work, but it is really quote unquote saved our bacon.
And that's great. It's remarkable. I know we talked about this a little bit, but like, you know, I feel like we're running a fundamentally different business than we were 3 months ago, and it sounds like you guys are too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really inspiring to watch our whole crew kind of rise up to the challenge of reinventing what we do in the building.
Right.
This is totally different.
Now, did you find it hard to lead people into, you know, changing their jobs either partially or completely from what they were doing before? Presumably you have less people making cheese, but you need people packing boxes. And, you know, was it, you know, something that we're encountering here is a little bit of how do you change your mind?
Yeah. Well, I think the way that we did it was we changed everything, because we went to like social distanced shift work at the same time, right? Which meant that suddenly we had two shifts that didn't overlap, comprised of pods of either two or four people that didn't mix with other pods. And we had to reinvent all the work that happened in the building. And this was just part of it. You know, the mail order was just
one part. The scheduling alone on that gives me a headache.
It's been mental, and you know what? Like it's been hard. There's just no other word to describe it. You know, we have the best team. You know, if we've had any success, it's because we have the best team, and people are in it to win it. So, I'm pretty, I feel really privileged to be surrounded by people that are willing and able to, like, do the, like, build the airplane thing, I think is,
right.
For all those reasons, I'm optimistic.
It's good. I feel like optimism is something that in these times, it's like a superpower to be able to hold on to that and use and wield it in a productive way.
Yeah, you know, we have some significant challenges before us still, like really kind of significant challenges. It's like if you look at our, our production, every cheese has a very unique story. From an inventory and sales perspective, when social distancing went into effect, we learned that about 35% of our sales were going to chefs, into the food service.
Right, because you probably didn't necessarily have transparency into that exact number because of the way that you sell through wholesalers and distributors.
Yeah, we couldn't tell. We didn't really know. But there are certain cheeses where that is like, you know, much greater percentage. Like Bailey, we've learned, is actually 70% food service.
Wow.
Yeah. And so we have a couple of things going on. This is Bailey. We've got like, I think, 1,400 wheels of Bailey, which, you know, it was 2,800, a few days ago before.
Like, I know. I feel like it's going. Yeah, I feel like that was the number I heard a couple of days ago.
Yeah, it was 2,800 a few days ago, and we're down to 1,400. But that's still a lot of cheese.
Is that e-commerce? How are you blowing that out?
Well, it's way more than we've been giving away a lot of Bailey.
Right.
So if you order a quarter wheel of Bailey on our website right now, you get a half. You get an eighth. I'm sorry. If you order an eighth wheel, we like give you a quarter wheel. You know.
Oh, nice.
We're giving a lot of cheese away. We're doing the same.
Well, and it's better to get cheese into people's mouths than have it in the garbage can.
Yeah. But that's still a lot of pounds of cheese, and more than our mail order program is going to be able to touch. You know, and that's the thing about mail order is great, you know, top line sales, and but the volume isn't there. And,
right.
We're a volume wholesale based business, because we're interested in, the way we think about our business is really like acres of land plugged into a market, and, you know, number of cows on that land, on those acres. And one cow can produce 1,800 to 2,000 pounds of cheese a year. And that's a lot.
That's a lot of cheese. So I guess that brings me to my question, like, you know, how do you adjust? I always think of this when I talk to cheesemakers and they talk about inventing a new cheese, where it's just like, and I remember when you guys were developing Alpha Tolman, I was just like, you just make a fucking shit ton of cheese in different kind of iterations. You don't know if the salt level is going to be right. You don't know if the cultures are going to be right, or the fat content's going to be exactly this or that. And then you've got to age it for a year and wait and see.
Yeah, it's like Alpha Tolman's like a 20-year pro.
Right. And so, you know, where does that leave you net? Like, are you, how do you think about, in terms of short-term and long-term uncertainty, adjusting your production aside? Like, obviously you talked about selling the herd, but like, do you look at rejiggering soft cheese to hard cheese ratios?
Oh, yes.
Not knowing whether in a year from now you'll be a glut of hard cheese and people will want soft cheese again?
Yeah, it's really hard, because the thing about soft cheese is it's cash flow that really keeps, the business rolling along. And when you take your soft cheese production down and put milk into hard cheese instead, what you're doing is you're postponing cash flow, right? And that's extremely like painful. The other we're making as much soft cheese as we think we can sell, and maybe even a little more, because we'd rather not lose the opportunity for that cash flow, particularly now in this moment where we are going to live or die based on our ability to manage that cash flow. So if you make too much hard cheese, two things happen. One, you fill up your cellar. And two, you delay cash flow in a way that's like really painful for the business.
Right. So you could both bottleneck production, and you're just delaying the inevitable of having to make soft cheese because you don't have any room for more hard cheese.
Yeah.
And you're cutting off any, you know, immediate cash flow.
Yeah, and turns out that, you know, the moisture in Harbison, you know, because of the yield there, there's so much more margin for us in Harbison than there is in Alpha Tolman.
It's just a lot more water there.
Yeah, it's a water that that we put a value of about $255 a gallon on.
Wow, that's wild. It's funny. It also just occurred to me there's an analogy to be drawn there with like the Federal Reserve and like, you know, like just adding more deficit spending and putting that burden on the future to have to.
Yeah. And so the other issue, like for a business like ours, that's confounding is that we're at capacity in our cheddar vaults. So when we're not able to move cheddar out of the vaults, it means that we can't move younger cheese in, right? And we've learned this the hard way in the past, and that is that, like, this time of year, if you don't get cheese out, then you don't get the holiday sales in Q4, right? So it doesn't just bite you, like, the loss of sales now. You also get bit later when you haven't been able to turn that inventory, so you don't have ripe cheese to sell in the fourth quarter. And so we've been going on, you know, at really working on making sure that, like, Cabot cloth-bound movement doesn't slow down, because we believe there's going to be another round of social distancing in the fourth quarter. And the only thing worse than losing sales now is losing sales in the fourth quarter, because that's when cheesemakers and retailers, you know, make their bank for the year. So
yeah, and our whole system is set up to, you know, to suck it away then. And if you don't have enough of a nest egg put away in the fourth quarter, you really you can be in trouble.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So you're, to a certain extent, you're reading the tea leaves and trying to make educated guesses based on, you know, things that you don't necessarily know about, epidemiology and what have you, and hope that you've made the right choices, which you won't know the answer to for a while. But again, that is sort of the cheesemakers, like, that's the way. Like, you know, you make it the cheese that you have to age for 18 months or what have you. And, oh shit, you oversalted it. It'll be another couple of years before I...
You know, and I think one of the things that has really become clear is we're making decisions now about cheese for next year, right? That we'll sell in 2021. And nobody knows what the world's going to look like. But it's our relationship and inviting our customers into a dialogue so they can understand our business, and we can like help make sure that they have cheese to sell when the time comes, and that, like, the interdependence, the give and take, the dialogue, and the friendship and the partnerships that I think are going to be strengthened by this kind of experience gives me some kind of hope, because we're nothing without our customers on the one hand, but our customers all need great cheese, and I think there's a moment here where, like, retailers and chefs, consumers, and cheesemakers need to have some clear communication of and an understanding of what we all have to lose if the dollars don't flow, in strategic and in ways that can preserve, both cheesemakers and the whole chain, right? So
I'm gonna de-Mateoize that for a second. It sounds like what you're saying is a rising tide floats all boats, and we owe it to each other to ride the same tide and not, you know, not continue to kind of think of this as a zero sum scenario where if I win, you lose, and vice versa.
Yeah. I've been working on this thing called Victory Cheese. And the tagline for our Victory Cheese is choose it or lose it. It's a play on Victory Gardens.
I feel like I saw something from Anne Saxelby just today about that.
Yeah, right. So we've got Anne going on this idea. And it really is, a lightning rod for PR to basically help tell the story of what's happening in American cheese and give chefs who are doing curbside and retailers the opportunity to, support American artisan cheesemakers in a really kind of overt way, because if we don't figure out how to like connect consumers with American cheese in this moment, there's going to be a lot of cheesemakers that won't make it.
Right.
You know, so we have a lot to lose, but I think we also have this great opportunity to strengthen the chain.
Band together and
band together. Yeah, we're all in this together. You know, we hear it all the time.
Well, I can't think of a better note to leave it on. And I have to say, it's really refreshing and inspiring to have a conversation based in optimism and looking forward to the PC era.
Yes.
I think it makes me feel a little bit better, and it also enjoins me and Foster Sundry and other retailers to the cause, and we certainly, I think, share a lot of the same values and want to be a part of Victory Cheese and of the future of the industry.
Yeah, thanks, man.
So Matteo, thank you so much. My guest again is Matteo Keeler, co-founder of The Cellars at Jasper Hill Farm, cheesemaker, entrepreneur, bon vivant. This has been Cutting the Curd Radio. I am your host, Aaron Foster, on the Heritage Radio Network, and we'll see you soon. Be well, be safe, so long.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.